yesterday I started explaining, motivating how by the apparent failure of quantizing gravity non-perturbatively, people have been led to consider other possibilities, alternative non-perturbative ways of quantizing. And what is the kind of the one-line characterization of what one means by non-perturbative? In general, it means one wants to have a formalism that is able to cope with configurations, whatever those are in the quantum theory, that are far away in some sense to be further specified from any classical solution. Now, what do we then mean by quantization? Well, we'll learn more about this this week and the next. I mentioned to you that there are the two ways, the canonical and the covariant way of quantizing. And we got started straight away by doing things the canonical way. I was starting to recap canonical Hamiltonian structures, because this is what canonical quantization builds on. The Hamiltonian, as opposed to the Lagrangian structure, which is the starting point for the covariant quantization. So what we were really looking at classically is dynamics on phase space. A more fancy way is to say we have some manifold with an additional structure, and that structure is a symplectic structure. And you should understand that, although I won't now go into kind of fancy differential geometry to formalize this somewhat, but just be aware that this is so the manifold of what one calls phase space plus this additional structure. It's like having a manifold plus a metric structure. Before, you don't have the metric structure. Well, you know what points are, you know what neighborhoods are, but you don't know what distances are. And in the similar vein, we get the symplectic structure that endows functions on the manifold, so that we then call a phase space, with the algebraic structure. So that's what you know as the Poisson brackets. And that, of course, appear in an integral way in how you formulate the dynamics. So as we saw, we could write the Hamilton equations of motion using these Poisson brackets. Now, really what becomes of the algebra of functions, say the C infinity functions on that phase space, is a Lie algebra, but it's infinite dimensional because there's an infinite number of functions. So there is even the basis of that space is infinite dimensional. And really, I also briefly mentioned that you can associate in a unique way with each function a vector field using the Poisson brackets. And if you look at the commutator algebra of these vector fields, you'll find it's actually isomorphic to the algebra of the functions under Poisson, taking the Poisson brackets. So this is really one and the same structure. So what quantization then means is preserving as much as possible of that structure in the quantum theory, but of course also solving the dynamics. So it's not just that we have a phase space and we have perhaps coordinates that characterize the phase space. We also have a Hamiltonian that is somehow a function of one's basic variables. And of course, one's primary interest is in trying to understand the dynamics, the quantum dynamics behind that. Now, I then quoted a theorem to you, which says that it's not the case, really, that given a classical system with a certain phase space, that you can in a one-to-one manner translate that into a quantum system where all these functions are represented by self-adjoint operators in such a way that the Poisson, the classical Poisson bracket relations, get mapped isomorphically into commutator relations of these operators. It's just not possible. So that was the content of this Grunewald-Van Hove result. And so that should already lower your expectations somewhat in terms of what one may be able to do. So what does it mean to quantize? And of course, we're phrasing the question in a kind of suggestive way to say, okay, I start with a classical system, and then I apply some kind of quantization procedure, and then I get a quantum theory. You might argue that's, of course, not really the right physical way to think about things. But physical theories are quantum theories, kind of in the first place, and then in some appropriate limits they go over into classical ones. So, but of course, well, we usually don't really know our only kind of starting point or way how to proceed is to start with some classical structure. Often, but of course not always. Now, why doesn't all of this bother us, or why were we not aware of this when we were taught quantum mechanics? Well, it's because very simple systems, like that of the harmonic oscillator, say, can be quantized without ever mentioning these issues, because that's sufficiently simple. And certainly one thing that comes to our help in standard quantum mechanics on Rn or R3, quantum mechanics, let's say Rn, some n-dimensional phase space, is that we have actually a unique representation in the quantum theory of the so-called Heisenberg algebra. So the Heisenberg algebra is really the subalgebra which I get by looking at all the QIs, the PIs, and I adjoin the constant function 1 to it. So of 1 QI PI, and the algebra is just what I get when I take the Poisson brackets. And so what one then does, okay, say, fine, then I have this unique quantization, say, in terms of where, say, these are represented by multiplication, sorry, these guys, and these are represented by partial differentiation with respect to QI. And what I then do is I simply add whatever Hamiltonian there was, and I try and use these substitution rules to map H to some H hat. As I said, for very simple, like the harmonic oscillator itself, this is unique. For the harmonic oscillator, well, sorry, for the kinetic term with any potential, V of Q, that exclusively depends on the coordinates, we also don't really run into operator ordering problems. And in a way, you could say, well, if you did, and if you have more than one alternative kind of to quantize a given classical Hamiltonian, you simply let experiment decide which one is the right quantum Hamiltonian. Because if they are distinct, well, that just means they must have a distinct spectrum, say. And then in principle, I could just go away and see, aha, well, Hamiltonian 1 seems to be the one that is realized because it predicts that spectrum, and that coincides with what I can measure. So that's, in a way, also a possible way to resolve ambiguity issues of a minor nature that might turn up here. Now, of course, I also said, well, one also suffers, of course, from a little bias being taught quantum mechanics for those systems which one can just solve in closed form. Of course, most quantum mechanical systems, again, are just not like this, and they can only be treated with perturbative methods. Okay, so, but here you might also be misled and simply never realize that there might be an issue at all with the quantization. Now, one more thing I wanted to say. So in this situation where you have this, you're given this negative result that there is no kind of quantization map, where I take, you know, all the classical phase-based functions and map them to self-adjoint operators. One possible quantization strategy would be to confine oneself to a specific subalgebra of classical space phase-based functions. Subalgebra. Sorry, of these smooth phase-based functions. And that is actually, as we see, a strategy that has been chosen in canonical quantum gravity when one decided to perhaps quantize a subalgebra of so-called loop variables. And of course, one has to then kind of make sure that, well, there are not too few in the subalgebra, so that actually all interesting operators kind of you want to quantize are kind of part of it or can be easily adjoined. Of course, doing this makes this, in general, a non-unique, well, it's your choice, right? Your choice that may be physically motivated and better should be in some way, but there are certainly, I mean, usually more than one, there's more than one way of doing it. So, and then, of course, one can ask, well, if I make different choices, are the results then equivalent? So what we did yesterday briefly was then this very simple finite dimensional classical Hamiltonian setting. What we'll need for gravity or quantum gravity is somewhat less straightforward. We need to refine this formalism, first of all, to deal with the situation that we have a gauge symmetry floating around. So here, of course, when you do the standard quantum mechanics, usually, well, all degrees of freedom, I mean, what you see is what you get. I mean, all the x's or the qi's and the pi's, they are physical, at least in principle, physically observable. So but we have to, what we're dealing with in gravity is not only of course, that we are in an infinite dimensional setting where we want to kind of quantize or quantize on infinite dimensional phase spaces of configuration fields and canonically conjugate momentum fields. But also we have to deal with the issue of fixing somehow or dealing with a redundancy that is in the system because we have a big gauge group that acts and maps physical solutions onto physical solutions. So that is this group of diffeomorphisms which we've talked about earlier. And of course, lastly, and in part because of that, we have then to deal with a quantization that happens on a space that is not linear. And of course, all of these things, well, they multiply kind of difficulties on top of each other. Now, let's take now a first step. Remain within this finite dimensional setting, and now look how I have to modify the formalism if I have gauge symmetry here. That means some of the directions in my finite dimensional phase space I regard as kind of gauge directions, so physics doesn't change with respect to them. How does this play out in this Hamiltonian formulation? And this goes by the name of constrained Hamiltonian systems. And it's a subject you're not likely to hear about in any standard lecture in your whatever undergraduate or at master's level. So let us first of all let me define what I mean by a system with gauge invariance or the form that it takes to start with in the Lagrangian formalism, and then we'll translate what this means then in the Hamiltonian framework. So let me start by making a definition. An n-dimensional Lagrangian system is called singular if, now let me write it down first and then explain, the determinant of a certain matrix, capital W, ij, 0, where wij is defined as a matrix of second derivatives of the Lagrangian with respect to the velocities qi dot. And you may have come across this thing. This is also called the Hessian. And actually, you see, when we were talking about the issues that appear when in the path integral, when we do QED, or even when we do linearized gravity, that when we try and isolate the propagator, what we actually did, right, you write then the action as in some form as, you know, the Lagrangian rather, say for scalar field in the form phi, and some kind of operator possibly, I mean usually, of course, including second order in derivatives, right, acting on phi itself, so you have this kind of quadratic expression, and then your propagator is just the inverse of this matrix. Now, you see the problems that we encountered in linearized gravity, and that was already present in Maxwell's theory, is that this M has zero eigenvectors, and therefore it's not invertible. And you see, this is just the finite dimensional version of this. If the quadratic matrix of my velocities, if that has singularities, it also means there are zero eigenvectors. What does that now mean? Yeah, so I cannot then invert, it's singular in this, just according to my definition. What more can I say? Of course, I can say how many zero eigenvectors there are, and if that was an n-dimensional system, let's say the number of these zero eigenvectors is little m, then the rank is exactly n minus m, and that is the same as saying there exist m zero eigenvectors. Of this matrix W. So what does that mean? Say multiplying from the right, doesn't really matter. I have the eigenvectors, let me call them yi, and left let me give them a label little a. So a runs from 1 to m. This is 0. So what interests us, I mean, what are the implications for the Hamiltonian formulation? Of course, how do I always get to the Hamiltonian formulation? By making a Legendre transformation. And what does it entail? What does it amount to? It amounts to substituting velocities in terms of momenta p. Now, the thing to realize is that when the rank of this W is not maximal, so when the determinant vanishes, that I cannot do this in a one-to-one manner. It's very easy to see. So let me just write this here, on the left, on the right board. So what does the Legendre transform do? It maps qi dots, for all I into QI and PI. But now, in this situation, this is also singular. Because, well, just taking the determinant here, why do I do this? So that's, of course, the same by my definition as taking the determinant of this matrix. So I just substitute in what I said here. But of course, now a single dL by del Q J dot, say, is the by my usual definition, is the corresponding PJ. So what this here is nothing but del PJ by del QI dot. And that is zero. And this now, of course, has an interpretation of the Jacobian of the transformation, which substitutes my QI dots by my PIs. But that tells me, well, unfortunately, the Jacobian vanishes. Right? So it's not a one-to-one map. Now, what are the consequences of this? Well, it means that I cannot solve for all qi dot. So I cannot write them as qi dot function of, well, all the q's and the p's. So I'm suppressing here the index. In other words, we see an example just in a second. We actually find that there are little m, so one for each zero eigenvector, m relations among the q's and the p's. So let me call them phi a of q and p equal to zero, or a runs from 1 to m. And these relations are called constraints. Right, so that is a constraint of the constrained Hamiltonian system. So and for all of this formalism to go through nicely, let me assume that these are algebraically independent, these phi a. I won't mention that again, but just as a side remark, that's kind of the standard, the regular case assumed independent. There's all kind of weird things might in principle happen, but let's not talk about those. Now, if these are independent, what immediately follows is that, well, the surface, the subspace of the phase space where these m relations hold simultaneously is, of course, of dimension 2n minus m. 2n, because I have n qi's, I have n pi's, and now I have m relations. So that puts me then on what is called the constraint surface. So this defines A to N minus M dimensional constraint surface. So let me call this curly S, subscript C for constraint, and that's a subspace of my original phase space S. Let's just do a very simple and trivial example just to illustrate what's happening and to show that there's no magic involved. So here is my example. It's just some finite dimensional Lagrangian I've cooked up for the purpose. So let L be equal to 1/2 Q1 dot squared plus some constant C Q2 dot Q1 minus m half Q1 squared plus Q2 squared plus Q3 squared. So I'm assuming that n equal to 3, and I have just 3 coordinates Qi. And you can see already that the kinetic term is for sure not regular, so the only direction where this has a regular quadratic term is a Q1, then Q2 appears linearly, Q2 dot rather, and Q3 dot doesn't appear at all. So it's clear that the rank won't be 3 for sure. Now, let us define our momenta. P1 is partial derivative of L with respect to Q1 dot. And this is Q1 dot. So far, so good. P2, analogously, is partial derivative of L with respect to Q2 dot. And that gives me a C times Q1. And P3 is del L del Q3 dot, and that simply vanishes. And if I now look at, of course, if I look explicitly at what Wij is, it's a 3x3 matrix, with entries 1, 0, 0. So clearly this has just rank 1. And therefore, according to what I have written here, I must find now two constraints. The things are called phi here. That means two relations, algebraic relations, relating the Q's and the P's in some way. And indeed, they're already written here. It's just these equations here, this one and that one. So if you like, phi 1, my first constraint, is I can rewrite it as P2 minus CQ1 equal to 0. So that involves just these two phase space coordinates, P2 and Q1. And phi 2 is identical with P3 equal to 0. So here are my two phase space constraints. And obviously, they put me on a four-dimensional subspace of my full phase space, of all the QIs and all the PIs. Now, a definition, a Hamiltonian system with such constraints can come in various flavors, and that depends, very roughly speaking, on whether these different phis, whether they Poisson commute or they don't. So if they all Poisson commute, then they could be like all of a position character or all of a momentum character, because these things commute among themselves. But if I get mixed pairs, so some of these kind of phis, they commute to some constant or some other function. I'll define this in a second. Then this has actual implications for the counting of degrees of freedom already of the classical system. So what is relevant for our purposes is the following case. So a Hamiltonian system with M constraints of the type we've just discussed, and let me again call them phi A of QP equal to 0. Now this is called of first class, if the Poisson brackets phi I, phi A, and phi B gives you a linear combination of the constraints with some coefficients F A B C phi C. So that's just a statement about this set of constraints. Now comes another condition that involves the Hamiltonian. Of course, we haven't yet talked about it, but there will be some Hamiltonian floating around in the system. So what else has to be satisfied? That each phi A Poisson commutes with the Hamiltonian to give back a linear combination of the constraints. So this is my Hamiltonian. Defining the dynamics of my system. And these are some coefficients. And this is just a linear combination of the constraints. So what we are saying is Poisson brackets among the constraints themselves can be expressed as linear combinations of the constraints again, and similarly the commutator, the Poisson brackets with H of any one of those, again, gives rise to a linear combination of the constraints. And these actually, they need not be constant necessarily. So that, yeah. These needn't be constants on phase space, that is. Just as an aside. Now, this motivates one. So all of this formalism is due to Dirac, essentially. Let me just say one more thing. And because one operates, of course, one now puts oneself on this constrained surface. So all this interesting physics is now confined to the subspace of phase space. Well, of course, these phis all vanish. So for various purposes, you can think of these as being zero, right? And therefore, it's handy to introduce a new notation that takes that into account, and that is this wiggly equality sign. And that means things are equal on the constrained surface. Okay, so if I use this, this means equality on SC. So, for example, we can now write that, you know, since the right-hand side of these clearly vanish on the constrained surface, one can now write, for example, phi A Poisson bracket with phi B is weakly equal to zero. That's how one phrases this. Yeah, there was a question.
Frobenius theorem.
Say that again.
Related to Frobenius theorem, the integrability theorem.
The integrability. Well, You could say that. Of course, as I said already, well, I'm putting myself on the surface, and I have to be careful that things are independent. But actually, the next step in our procedure, you'll see, is more related to Frobenius' theorem. In a way, you'll see. Because, as you'll see, I mean, obviously, the presence of a set of first-class constraints will put us on the submanifold of phase space. But there is another thing that happens, namely that if these two conditions are satisfied, that turns out now to be an action of the gauge group. So it turns out that this constraint surface can be decomposed into orbits where points along an orbit are physically equivalent. So not only does it confine me to live on a sub-manifold of phase space, the presence of these first-class constraints, but it also induces, there is still a gauge symmetry then floating around, which I have to get rid of. So in the end, I want them to talk about the space of orbits. So I want to do something very similar on this constraint surface, which we did when, in the Lagrangian formulation, we talked about gauge fixing. But now we see it kind of play out in the Hamiltonian formalism. So there are two effects. One also calls that the first class constraints, they strike twice. So, and we'll see that, we see how this manifests in the counting of the degrees of freedom in the presence of such constraints in a second. Now we'll explore a little bit the consequences of these two conditions that might now appear a little mysterious. I mean, what further implications that they have. Now, the first implication, or the implication for all interesting kind of observables, including primarily, of course, also the Hamiltonian, is that it turns out that they are not unique. But you have a whole collection of Hamiltonians where my original Hamiltonian is kind of the first part. But then what I do, I adjoin an arbitrary linear combination of my constraints. But clearly, because the constraints vanish on the constraint surface, here I'm adding zero. Right? So clearly, well, the value of the Hamiltonian is still the same. But of course, what is not the case is that when I now start taking Poisson brackets with respect to this new Hamiltonian, well, then these pieces, they will, in general, give you a non-trivial contribution. Yeah, because although they vanish, of course, taking Poisson brackets means will involve taking derivatives of these things also. And they, of course, they do not have to vanish at all. So they coincide on the constraint surface, but are not quite so innocent. Well, we said now, let's see. Okay, so that's what I wanted to say and what's written here. So these pieces will in general contribute to the equations of motion. So let us just look. I mean, what form does this take? Let us take some arbitrary phase space function and look at its time evolution. And the way I get the time evolution is by taking commutator with the Hamiltonian. Right? And now let's see what kind of difference these terms make. So my arbitrary phase space function, I call it little g of Q and P in C infinity of phase space functions. Okay, so what is g dot? Let us work out kind of what the various pieces are. So first I have just the piece I'm expecting from the Hamiltonian, the original Hamiltonian. Of course, I'm assuming this was given to me. You know, when I was given the system, I was given the phase space, and I was given a Hamiltonian. So it's just part of the data I was given. Now, of course, I have to see what this linear combination does. So the Poisson brackets, this needn't be constants. So the Poisson brackets will act on this piece, and they will act on that piece. Okay, so I get a CM G with phi M plus a phi M G Poisson brackets with CM. So I get these two terms, and here, well, sum over m is understood, right? It's just whatever, my finite bunch of constraints, phi. Now, what is kind of clearly irrelevant, what doesn't contribute, is this latter part here, because it's multiplied by phi m, and phi m's are weakly zero. They vanish on the constraint surface. And that's all. I'm now, you know, entirely just interested in stuff that happens on the constraint surface. So this don't give me, these last things don't give me a contribution. So they're weakly equal to zero. But of course, it's not true for this term in general. So this will give me a non-trivial contribution. These CMs are just some non-vanishing functions. See? And so in particular, if I now write down kind of Hamiltonian equations of motion for my Qs and Ps, as I usually do, so on the constraint surface, say my qi dot, so I'm now considering the special case where my phase space function happens to be one of the coordinate functions on phase space, q or p. So qi dot is just sticking them into this last relation here. So I have the standard term, which is just partial derivative of h with respect to pi. But now I get this additional term over there with a constant cm d phi m by d pi. And similarly, pi dot is weakly equal to minus dh dqi minus cm d phi m by dot qi. So now you see what I mean by non-uniqueness of the evolution. So these cms I just chose, you know, I can make any choice. So these CMs are just arbitrary functions, which means that the solutions to my equations of motion appear to depend on a bunch of arbitrarily chosen functions. So the evolution is non-unique because I could have chosen these to be anything. Okay? That's, of course, not exactly what you had in mind when you're trying to solve the system. So that's what we conclude. That's what appears to be happening. The equation of motion contain m, if I had, you know, m independent constraints here, arbitrary, phase-space functions, namely these CMs. Now, in order to have a consistent system, of course, well, one thing is quite clear, that it cannot, well, if initially, kind of as the initial data I start with are on the constraint surface, then my Hamiltonian should better be compatible with those in the sense that the evolution generated by it shouldn't lead me away from the constraint surface. So only that will give rise then to a consistent system where, well, it doesn't lead me to a violation of the constraints that are clearly there. I mean, I've just computed them. They're just there kinematically. So these phi's have to vanish. So that's my first remark. So in order for things to be consistent, consistency, and how that relates to the ambiguity here, how we deal with that, that will become clear in a second. So the constraints must be preserved in time. That's just rephrasing what I said before. Let me just erase this here on the next blackboard. So what does that mean? Phi m dot should be equal to zero. Because that, I mean, the dot and the time evolution is what the Hamiltonian does for me, of course. So what does it look like in terms of formulas? Well, it just means that phi m, just looking back at what I wrote there, h plus cn. Now, I have now given a specific m, and now I'm summing over n. I hope that's sufficiently clear. Should vanish. So that's what I'm saying. This better happen in order for me to have consistency. Of course, the one start assumption which I just erased in the definition of the first class system just stipulated that Poisson brackets of two phi's should again be a linear combination of the phi's. So it's actually true. So that, therefore, by assumption, that is weakly zero. Initial assumption for for a first-class system, the definition of which I just erased. And it makes it clear why I also needed that other condition that appeared there. So that was one of the other, this two-start assumption. So this is also zero. So that is, now we're seeing already why I needed to impose these conditions to make sure that I have a consistency, I mean, between the presence of these constraints and the dynamics given by the Hamiltonian. So it's useful to think of that on, or to look at what this geometrically implies on phase space in terms of kind of the flows that are generated by both the phi and the h. So there are two ways of reading the condition, in particular, that psi m, any constraint for any value m, should vanish on the constraint surface. So the first one is to say that kind of the flow of the Hamiltonian H stays on SC, the constraint surface. Now, what does, how, let me rewrite this condition kind of accordingly. So what, how can I rewrite it to make this interpretation kind of geometric interpretation obvious? This I can, I'm using now the explicit expression for the Poisson brackets. So I'm rewriting this as a sum over I. Let us assume I have globally well-defined coordinate and momenta minus del H del QI d by d PI partial differential plus dH d PI d by dQI applied on phi m. So I've simply written, I've just used the definition of what the Poisson brackets do, the way these partial derivatives act. I've just written it in a suggestive way. So that what's tense here is essentially what I call the Hamiltonian vector field associated with the Hamiltonian itself. You see, here, these are my directions, my unit directions kind of in the different phase space direction, and these are the coefficients. So this is a vector field. That is what I called the vector field capital X. And that happens to be the Hamiltonian vector field associated with a particular space, phase space function, namely H itself, up to a minus sign, actually. So this is what I yesterday called capital X associated with the phase space function H. Psi m is equal to zero, or is weakly equal to zero, rather. So the way to read it is this Hamiltonian vector field, when I sit on the constraint surface, it always goes in a direction that doesn't change any of the phis. And that means, of course, it stays tangential to that surface. Because the surface is, of course, defined by psi m, phi m are all zero. So if I stay, so or constant, if you like, that would be the same, that would be the same. But it happens to be zero. Now here, all of these, the Hamiltonian vector field is therefore it stays always tangential to that surface. And that's fine, because it means, of course, that I can now integrate the flow lines by only staying within that surface. So I can solve the dynamics consistently. Okay. But of course, there is also kind of, I can look at an alternative geometric interpretation. Of course, formally, they look all the same, but you know, it helps kind of to try to think geometrically of both of these. So the second interpretation I can give is that H is unchanged when, that is kind of the converse interpretation, unchanged when moving along kind of the directions given by the vector fields, x associated with each one of the constraints on the constraint surface. Now, let me write, let me take again just the very same relation I had here, and let me write it in another suggestive way as sum over I del phi m del qi d by d pi minus del phi m del pi by d qi operating on h. So this is, of course, exactly the same. It's exactly the same algebraic expression. But of course, what this here is now for each value of little m, this is a Hamiltonian vector field associated with the constraint phi m. So these are, again, the directions, in the direction of the partial derivatives of the phase space coordinate functions, and these are the coefficients. So this is the vector field associated with the constraints phi m applied onto H. And this is supposed now to vanish on the constraint surface. So and you see, this is now kind of a different kind of interpretation. So I'm now on this constraint surface, and I now look, there is, for each, let's pick out one of these phis, and what I'm saying, there is an associated vector field, and if I look at the flow lines, if I follow the flow lines of this vector field, so kind of I integrate it up, then the Hamiltonian won't change. That means the dynamics won't change. That means this corresponds to a kind of gauge direction. Yeah, so an unphysical direction, you know, if I walk along this direction, nothing will change. And this is true for all of the constraints. So all of these constraints generate kind of superfluous, redundant directions within my phase space as I move along now my constraint surface. So in other words, this, I therefore interpret these vector fields as corresponding kind of to what I would call a gauge direction on SC. So the physics doesn't change when I move along that direction. And let me just give you a kind of a baby example to illustrate this. So let my constraint be given by P3, so the vanishing thereof. I mean, now then the vector field corresponding to this constraint is just using Poisson brackets, is the partial derivative with a minus sign this in the direction of the conjugate variable of P3, which is Q3. So in other words, d by dq3, if my Hamiltonian abates this consistency condition, zero on the constraint surface. So let us draw a little picture to see what's going on. Let this big box be my phase space or part of it. So this is S. Now, let us go onto the surface defined by the vanishing of the constraints. So this is defined by, in this case, P3 equal to 0. Say there was a six-dimensional phase space, this is now a subspace of co-dimension one, so of one dimension less. And on this, now, if I move now on this space, we've seen that the constraint itself, it generates, via its Hamiltonian vector field, it generates kind of direction. So actually, wherever I look on the constraint surface, I can draw what this Hamiltonian vector field is. It's this minus, well, proportional to d by d q3. So it always points in the q3 direction. And what the consistency condition tells me is that physics is unchanged when I walk along the flow lines, the integrated flow lines of that direction. And of course, to integrate the flow lines is completely trivial in this case. So they just say, well, I walk so that Q3 remains a constant. So each of these orbits, if you like, so these are the flow lines along which Q3 changes, right? But I identify pairs of points because they're physically equivalent. The Hamiltonian doesn't change. So, and the quotient space, so if I gauge fix something, well, the quotient space, let me illustrate this by, this will be just kind of a cut through all of these orbits again. So this would be kind of the physical phase space where, first of all, I've gone to the constraint surface, and then I have divided out by the redundancy in that gauge direction. And of course, here it's a very simple example. It just means I drop the dependence on Q3 everywhere. Right? And nothing will depend on Q3. That's the message. And this phase space will then be, if this was, say, six-dimensional, the surface was five-dimensional, this quotient space, physical space, will be four-dimensional. Okay. So this is the physical phase space, so the space of gauge orbits, or however you want to call it. So that is, so that basically ends my discussion here. So you could also say another way of writing it, somewhat formally, would to say, well, the physical phase space is again a space of equivalence classes with respect to the equivalence relation induced by the gauge orbits. Of course, if I have a single constraint, each gauge orbit will just be one dimensional. Of course, if I have m independent gauge constraints, they will each generate an independent gauge direction on the constraint surface, and then each orbit would be m-dimensional. And I'm factoring out, well, by I'm getting rid of m directions in my phase space. So that's just another way of writing it. And so the dimension of the space is 2n minus 2m. If all these, so that holds exactly for the first class system I've defined, with the condition satisfying these consistency conditions. And this is what I meant by saying the first class constraints, they strike twice. So each one, for each one of them, I subtract two dimensions from my phase space. One, because I'm confining myself to this constraint service. Two, because I'm factoring out by an equivalence class along the constraint surface. So just one very last thing, so which not only has to hold for the Hamiltonian, any physical observable has to be kind of invariant under the action of the gauge, these gauge flows on the constraint surface. And we have already seen what the condition for that is. Well, it's a vanishing of a relation of that kind. So what I mean by this is a physical observable that might be the Hamiltonian, it might be something else, is F is one that satisfies F with all of the psi is weakly equal to zero. And that's the consistency condition for something to be called an observable by me. And what it implies is that this observable F, it will project down, as one says, to this quotient space in a unique way. Because it doesn't, again, it doesn't change along the flow lines of the gauge directions. And therefore, it takes a value, a fixed value on any given orbit. So when I quotient it out by the orbits, I get a well-defined function. So this is implies that F, sorry for writing this so low on the board, it projects to a well-defined function on the physical quotient, the physical phase space. So good references for all of this. I mean, where does this all come from? I mean, I said Dirac is a key name. Many of these things were motivated by wanting to understand gravity. So not by wanting to play with, you know, finite dimensional Hamiltonian system with constraint. No. Well, gravity is kind of was the prime motivation behind defining all these structures and, you know, making it clear, you know, what is the gauge direction, what is physical, how do I do with this in a canonical context. And it's mainly due to Dirac. And the beautiful reference are his 1964 lectures on quantum mechanics, where it is laid out crystal clear, and in a way that is immediately readable, even for us nowadays, and makes all of this very clear. Okay, so much for today. See you back tomorrow.